Genesis 42 and Genesis 43 tonight. There's quite a lot of content, so we're going to try and keep up the pace. But if we don't quite finish, then that is fine too. As far as Jacob and Joseph's brothers are concerned at this point in Genesis, Joseph is dead. For all practical intents and purposes, Jacob is convinced he's dead. Joseph's brothers know he was alive when he left them, but he ended up being a slave on his way to Egypt, so there's no chance of him probably being alive and well. But Joseph is not only alive, but he's married with two children. He's ruling over Egypt, and the reason why the whole earth is going to survive a severe multi-year drought is because of Joseph. This is all because of Joseph's faithfulness to God, and more importantly, this is all because of God's providential arrangement of all the ups and downs of Joseph's life, so that the one descendant of Abraham in Egypt is going to be the cause for blessing to Egypt, especially, and then also to the rest of the earth. And so that's where we pick up the story in Genesis 42. But Genesis 42 is back in the land of Canaan. We're back with Jacob and Joseph's brothers. Genesis 42, verse 1. When Jacob, so don't forget Jacob, he's in the promised land, the land of Canaan still. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said, I'm going to struggle, am I not? Cameron, could you read verse 1 to 5 for us, please?
When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan.
Thank you. You're designated reader for tonight. We're back in Canaan with Jacob. The drought at the end of verse 41, it says it was in Egypt and over all the earth, went as far as Canaan, in the land of what's now Israel, obviously, so all the way from Egypt to Israel. Then in verse 4, you have that little detail of Benjamin that will be very important later on. He did not send Benjamin. It's very explicitly mentioned there. It's going to be very significant for the rest of the story. But it also makes you remember how Joseph left. Okay, Jacob is convinced that Joseph, his oldest son through Rachel, his favorite wife, is dead. And so the next son, the only other son through Rachel, is definitely going to be treated very special. So Benjamin is getting the same kind of treatment that Joseph had. And so you're immediately reminded, just by that comment, of all the drama that's still part of Jacob and his many sons. Then verse 5 says that the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. So if all these people coming to buy, and then you shouldn't forget the last comment in verse 57 of the previous chapter. It says, "Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain." It's personal. It doesn't just say to Egypt, and Joseph was in charge of Egypt. It says you have to come to Joseph. So when verse 5 says they came to buy, you're like, wait, they're going to bump into Joseph. There's a person, not just a process or a government department. Verse 6 to 17, please, Cameron.
"Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. 'Where do you come from?' he said. They said, 'From the land of Canaan, to buy food.' And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, 'You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land.' They said to him, 'No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies.' He said to them, 'No, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see.' And they said, We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. But Joseph said to them, It is as I say to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother, while you remain confined, that your words may be tested, whether there is truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies. And he put them all together in custody for 3 days.
That's fine, thank you. 12 verse 17. Alright, so I said when they came to buy grain, you immediately think, wait, Joseph is the one who sells grain, and that's how verse 6 starts. Now Joseph was governor. They immediately, the narrator, God's inspiration here, makes you connect it to their coming to Joseph. The grain is just the occasion. They're coming to Joseph. They bow down with their faces to the ground, reminiscent of his dreams in chapter 37, right? He recognizes them, but they do not recognize him. Now, this could have been up to 15 years later, but he recognizes them. They don't recognize him at all. And they're surprised, really, right? He's presumed dead. He's very much Egyptian now, even his Egyptian name and things like that. And he is treating them the way an Egyptian would treat them. And so there's no reason for them to really recognize. And that's a fair reality. Don't judge them for that. Joseph makes the dream connection right away because he remembered, verse 9, the dreams that he had dreamed of them. So again, when they bow down, we already make the connection. But in case you missed it, the text explicitly tells us, Joseph, remember, dream where they bow down before me. This is happening right now. And then, verse 9 says, you are spies, you've come to see the nakedness of the land. You heard there is a drought in Egypt, you've come to see how bad it is, you are all spies. Now, we're not exactly told why Joseph comes with this accusation of suspicion. I don't think he is suspicious, but he gives this accusation of suspicion. But it's not hard for us to fill in the gaps, really, either. He knows their untrustworthiness. He knows their deceptive hearts. And therefore, he accuses them of a crime that, though it's not the crime they're guilty of, they're not spies, it is the crime that has the same heart issues. A spy is deceptive. He cannot be trusted with the truth. And so he accuses them of a similar crime, espionage in this case, spying on the harsh conditions of Egypt. Then, verse 10, they answer him and say, no, but you have come to buy food. So they first, four very important defenses here, and their significance is important. First, they confirm their real motive. No, we're not coming here to spy, we're coming here to buy food. That's really the only motive. The superficial reason is the reason. Secondly, they affirm that they have one father. Now, that's not a random statement. It's a bit weird for 10 people, 10 grown men to show up and say, we're here to buy food, and we're from a family in Canaan. Of course that's suspicious, okay? When else have you seen 10 grown men show up and they're literally just here to buy food and they're from one family? So they affirm, no, we really all have one dad, okay? It's true, we're all sons of the same man. Verse 11, we are all sons of one man. So that's the second thing. They affirm the one father, leaving out the details of two more brothers. For now it's just we all belong to one father. Three, they vouch for their own character. We are honest men. Now, this is the one defense that's actually not true. They are not honest men. They might be honest in that moment. They are all from Jacob. They do have one father, and they are only here to buy food, but they're not honest men. And then third, they claim innocence of the charge. They're not spies. We've never been spies, which again is true externally, but their heart condition is exactly the same. And so this isn't random by Joseph. This isn't some vindictive thing that Joseph is like, what do I do? I can't think of anything. Okay, you're spies. Let's just go with that for now. That gives me some time. No, there's a little calculation behind this. It seems very intentional. And so Joseph sticks to his charge. Verse 12 says, no, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see. He knows that defense 3 and 4 are of great concern. Though they've never been spies, their heart condition is the same, and they're not honest people. And so, a little tactic to find out truth when somebody is lying, you just let them keep talking. It's like when your kid says, no, I didn't do it, and you just kind of look at them until they disclose more information. Okay, it's a common to parenting, common to interrogation technique. So he just says, no, you are spies. Whatever your defense was is apparently not persuasive, so they're going to have to add to their defense. And he doesn't have to change anything. He's just going to keep accusing them of the same thing till they eventually reveal all the information of what's really going on. And so, verse 13, they repeat all the information, but they're adding some details. There's some more precise details. It's working. They said this. He's not convinced, so he just waits for them to keep talking. And now, instead of saying we're all of one man, they say, actually, we're 12 sons, but one is no more. So now he's getting to see what exactly they understand of what they've done with Joseph. They're just like, he isn't anymore. And then there's another little brother as well. We are one man in the land of Canaan. They're just adding details now. Verse 14 again, Joseph repeats the charge. Again, common tactic. And he says, I'm going to test you. And verse 15, 16, and 17 basically says, I'm going to test you. You've given me enough information that based on your words alone, not his knowledge of them, just on their words alone, he can now develop a good test to see if they're still honest or dishonest men or if they're actually honest. And so they reveal there's a small younger brother. And so he just uses the information they provided him to say, okay, go fetch him. When one of you has gone to fetch him, then I'll believe that you're honest men. Okay, your story is bizarre enough, so this is one way you can prove it. He says, by the life of Pharaoh, a bit of a strange concept. This is probably not him swearing by the name of Pharaoh like you would by the name of the true God or something like that. It just shows them the significance of this charge. He has the authority of Pharaoh. And so if he says they're spies, it's off with their head, or whatever form of execution the Egyptians used. He's probably not swearing by Pharaoh as a god, since Joseph is already clearly revealed to us as a God-fearer, and we're going to even see that in the rest of this encounter. And so he says, one of you need to go fetch your brother, but in the meantime, he puts them together in custody for 3 days. The word together, again, very significant. Normally, you don't put people who are lying in custody together because you don't want them to get their story straight amongst each other. Here, he wants them to be together so they can get their story straight. We are not honest men. Okay, this is God punishing us for the sins we have committed against our brother. Verse 18 to 24, please come.
On the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry bread for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Then they said to one another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. And Reuben answered them, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now, here comes a reckoning for his blood. They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. Then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them, and he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes.
That's and fine, just on there. So 24, thank you. Don't give all the details away just yet. Verse 18, he gives them some hope because he says, I am a God-fearer. Do this and you will live, for I fear God. So the plan right now is 3 days in custody and then one of you needs to go fetch your brother. I'm going to change the plan and this is going to be good for you. You have a chance of living now. And you need to understand the reason I'm giving you a chance like this is because I fear God. So we're reminded here that though you might be suspicious of Joseph's motives for treating them so harshly when he knew who they were, you have to understand, no, this is a God-fearing moment. And you understand, in the very next phrase, if you are honest men. And so he's testing the honestness. That text reveals to us what his purpose is. He's testing to see if they are honest men or not. If you are honest men, then let's do this. Let's draw attention to that one claim that was not entirely true, and it works very well. Because they, amongst each other then, immediately connect the dots. And so this isn't just providence superintending over random details. These are not random details. These are very carefully composed details by Joseph, and they accomplish their exact purpose. And so he has this test. Bring your youngest brother to me, so your words will be verified and you will not die. You have hope of life, but you're going to have to bring this youngest brother. This will test the veracity of their claim that they have a younger brother, but it will also test how they will treat Jacob and Rachel's only remaining son. And so he's literally going to test them with the same thing that happened to him. There's Jacob and Rachel's only other son is Benjamin. Let's see if they do to Benjamin what they did to the other son of Jacob and Rachel. They immediately connect the dots. Verse 21, they said to one another, in truth we are guilty. So in honesty, we are not honest. Okay, finally, full confession. You're just among themselves here. We're guilty concerning our brother. They connected. They're like, oh wait, he's testing us to see what happens with Benjamin. And actually, that's a really good test, because last time we had something to do with Rachel's son, we sold him and told our dad he died. It says here, 2 verse 21, some extra details which we didn't know in chapter 37. It says, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us. What we realize here, not revealed in chapter 37, is that Joseph was actually begging them for mercy. And they didn't listen. And now they are in a position where they will die if they don't get mercy from this governor. And so the situation, though so different, is exactly the same situation, actually. And concept is identical to chapter 37. Then even Reuben, there's another important detail that is similar. Reuben answered them, verse 22, did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? Remember, Reuben, the oldest of all the sons, was away at the moment of selling Joseph. Because remember, he comes back, he's like, hey, what do you guys do? First he's like, what did you do? You can't sell him, because he was going to pull him up again. Remember, Reuben was the one who's taking a little more serious responsibility there. Here again, Reuben is the one who connects the dots and says, I told you not to do this, and now God is punishing us for that sin. Verse 23 and 24 then makes Joseph realize that they arrived at his intended conclusion. All his carefully composed accusations, repeated accusations, how he kept them together, how he's focusing on his son, even though they don't know anything about that he knows, it's all from what they said, was there to drive them to the conclusion that we were not honest with our brother and with our father about our brother. So he realizes that he achieved his purpose, but it affects him emotionally, and so he composes himself to stick to the plan to actually test their honesty. In theory, it's going really well. And so Simeon is selected, possibly because he is next in age after Reuben, so he's the second oldest, and Reuben is actually the one guy who's less guilty, if you could say that. And so Simeon, the one who really should have taken a bit of responsibility, is kept in custody, and he is bound before their eyes. So they know exactly what's going on here. There's actually, as much as Joseph is sometimes accused of being deceptive, because he knows who they are, and he should act with that knowledge, and he's trying to deceive them because they don't know yet, this is actually an affirmation for us that Joseph is not being deceptive at all. Yes, he hasn't revealed his identity, but he is making it strikingly clear what he's doing, and it actually has that outcome. Simeon is bound before their eyes, they're eyewitnesses of everything, they're always together, there's no deception. Verse 25 to 28, the next little piece here.
And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain, and to replace every man's money in his sack, and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of his sack. Then he said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of my sack." At this, their hearts failed them, and they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?"
Till then, thank you. Joseph gives them their money back, albeit secretly. So as their grain filled, that's part of the deal, puts their money back. And this accomplishes a few things. Number one, it is evidence of Joseph's kindness to them. He's literally, in a drought, giving them food for free. Yes, they paid for it legitimately, but then he went and snuck their money back in their food. It also protects his identity because they don't know how the money came back. He just gave orders secretly, put their money back. And so it's not traceable to him directly. So his identity is still a secret. And it again makes them evaluate. Now, after the fact, it gives them a day of journey. Let them talk about everything that happened, and then again force them to evaluate what just happened. It's not just like, well, we're done, we're out of Egypt. No, that evening, they get to the motel, they pull off the road, they're feeding their donkey, putting petrol on the car, as it were, and they are like, oh, no, now there's money here. Like, what on earth is happening? I thought we left this behind us. So he's keeping it in the forefront of their mind. Then, you've got that comment in verse 28. What is this that God has done to us? Profound question. And that's a question you as the reader need to answer. What is God doing to them? Forget Joseph. We're very obsessed with what is Joseph doing? Come on, like, what's he trying to do? It's starting to make sense for us, but still it's a bit weird. That's not the right question. The right question is, what is God busy doing to them? It seems like he's terrorizing them for what they've done to Joseph. What is this that God has done? It's a loaded question. But for us who know both sides of the stories, okay, we're privileged readers here. We know what they don't know. We know what Joseph knows, and we know what the brothers know, and we know what the brothers don't know. The answer to this question, what is God doing to them, is God is doing a lot of good to them, money back in the bags, from the very evil that they have committed. They committed evil. From that evil, Joseph is happening in Egypt. And from that evil, they're getting money back unexpectedly. Free food, money's back. They're getting a lot of good. Now, this is actually the point of all these events. Because when Joseph, after he brings his whole family to Egypt, at the end, now I'm jumping forward, but a key statement out of Joseph's own mouth is, what you meant for evil, God meant for good. Chapter 50, verse 20. An anchor commentary. Yair is the first grand evidence of that, very personal. It's already vaguely there. Canaan is going to get food, survive a drought because of Joseph in Egypt. But Yair, very particularly, those 10 men are getting a lot of good from God. What is God doing to them? Because out of the evil that they have committed, this grand reversal, how God just, not even evil can stay evil when God gets involved. Verse 29 to 38.
When they came to Jacob their father in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, "The man, the lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, we are honest men. We have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan." Then the man, the lord of the land, said to us, "By this you shall know that you are. I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me, and take grain for the famine of your households, and go your way. Bring your youngest brother to me, then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land." As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, "You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Then Reuben said to his father, "Kill my two sons, if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol."
So they get back to Jacob, they retell all the details to him. It's kind of important because Simeon is missing, although he's notably absent from the retelling of the story. He's just chopped liver right now. He's still in Egypt. Simeon is in Egypt. Okay, remember that. So they retell the story because it's necessary, because they won't be able to return for more food if the drought continues if they don't bring back Benjamin. And so they retell the story. Simeon doesn't get a lot of mention at all. Then verse 35, Joseph actually returned all their money, not just one sack. In other words, they were literally saved from the drought for free, categorically. Absolute blessing. Jacob then looks at this all and says, no, we're not doing this. Let's pray. In other words, let's pray that the drought stops. Simeon can stay in Egypt, that's fine, but I'm not sending Benjamin. And Jacob starts counting the loss of his sons one by one. He actually considers Simeon. He's like, I've already lost Joseph. Now I've lost Simeon, and he counts it as a write-off. I'm not going to lose another one. In fact, I'm not going to lose the only one I have left. And in other words, Benjamin was being treated with the same respect and honor and privilege that Joseph was initially treated. The other sons are just not that important. They're the cause of all Jacob's problems, and they've made that he already lost two sons. He's not going to lose a third. Reuben vouches, again, kind of intercedes a little bit, vouches for Benjamin, says, "You can kill my two sons," as though Jacob would do that, kill his grandsons, just because Benjamin didn't come back. And so Jacob eventually says, no, nothing like that's going to happen. Benjamin won't go. It's as though he's his only remaining son. Chapter 43, verse 1 to 15.
Now the famine was severe in the land. And when they had eaten the grain that they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go again, buy us a little food." But Judah said to him, "The man solemnly warned us, saying, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother with us, we will go down and buy food. But if you will not send him, we will not go down.' For the man said to us, 'You shall not see my face unless your brother is with you.' Israel said, 'Why did you treat me so badly as to tell the man that you had another brother?' They replied, 'The man questioned us carefully about ourselves and our kindred, saying, "Is your father still alive? Do you have another brother?" What we told him was an answer to these questions. Could we in any way know that he would say, 'Bring your brother down?'" And Judah said to Israel, his father, "Send the boy with me, and we will arise and go, that we may live and not die, both we and you, and also our little ones. I will be a pledge of his safety. From my hand you shall acquire him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame forever. If we had not delayed, we would now have returned twice." Then their father Israel said to them, "If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the choice fruits of the land in your bags and carry a present down to the man, a little balm and a little honey, gum, myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Take double the money with you. Carry back with you the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was an oversight. Take also your brother and arise, go again to the man. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man, and may he send back your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the men took this present, and they took double the money with them, and Benjamin. They arose and went down to Egypt, and stood before Joseph.
Thank you. So they need more food, and later you realize they're like, we could have gone twice already. So they're really stretching the food because Jacob won't send them back for more food. But eventually it gets to a point where, like, look, we could have gone twice already. We really need to go now. And they're reminded, though, of that one criterion for returning. They have to bring Benjamin. And so you've kind of got Israel asking a very logical question in verse 6. Like, what's wrong with you guys? Like, why did you tell him you're Benjamin? You can kind of understand that. So I'm like, really? And they say, well, they put words in Joseph's mouth, verse 7. He questioned us carefully. Whether that's true or not, we don't know. It's not recorded for us in the previous chapter, but it's possible. It's unlikely, though, because the next person you are focusing on is Judah, and he was by far the most evil in chapter 37. So they put some words in Joseph's mouth, perhaps truthfully, perhaps not, saying, no, he specifically asked of all these things, but you already know he simply employed the anti-lie test, and they actually revealed that they have a younger brother. And so there's still some deception happening from them. Then Judah vouches for Benjamin and says, no, we'll bring him back. And you're reminded of the fact that they just put words in Joseph's mouth which weren't quite true to appease their father, instead of saying, no, we actually just disclosed it. And this is also the guy that was really bad in chapter 37. And so you and I, reading this, don't have a lot of confidence that Judah's pledge means anything. But Jacob eventually agrees and says, if it must be so, then do this. And you realize how wealthy Jacob is. Number one, he can pay for all the grain. He's not asking for a handout. And also, he's sending this significant peace offering to Joseph, the governor of Egypt. And he entrusts the outcome to God. He's like, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved. May God Almighty grant you mercy before the man. Not realizing a man is the one who cares more about Benjamin than any other one in Egypt. And so the men took his presents, they took double the money, so they're going to go back. And honesty, and so the honest thing again, they're going to come and pay double this time, because last time their money was found in there, so they just want to make sure we pay for that money, the food we took last time, without actually paying for it at the end of the day. And verse 15 says, they again stood before Joseph. Got a cool way to end that little section. They're again standing before Joseph. Verse 16 to 23.
When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, bring the men into the house and slaughter an animal and make ready, for the men are to dine with me at noon. The man did as Joseph told him and brought the men to Joseph's house. And the men were afraid because they were brought to Joseph's house. And they said, it is because of the money which was replaced in our sacks the first time that we are brought in, so that he may assault us and fall upon us to make us servants and seize our donkeys. So they went up to the steward of Joseph's house and spoke with him at the door of the house and said, O my lord, we came down the first time to buy food, and when we came to the lodging place, we opened our sacks, and there was each man's money in the mouth of his sack, our money in full weight. So we have brought it again with us, and we have brought other money down with us to buy food. We do not know who put our money in our sacks. He replied, peace to you, do not be afraid. Your God and the God of your father has put treasure in your sacks for you. I received your money. Then he brought Simeon out to them.
Then he brought Simeonite to them. Very important little detail there. But let's start back in verse 16 and 17. Joseph invites them for a private, even royal meal. Evidence, again, of goodness to them. They're terrified at that prospect. Okay? They're not excited about this. Their consciences are making them feel so bad, but they think it is only in terms of the money. Because they're like, yeah, they know that we took our money back with us too. So they, as they literally, you can see them, the nine of them, coming to Joseph's house. And it's like, hey, just before we go in, okay, we're terrified at entering this place. Can we just sort out this issue? Okay, let's clear up any misunderstanding. So they explain to the steward, hey, look, this is what happened. It wasn't us. We even brought money back. Well, like, everything is coming back. We're completely innocent about the money matter, which is true, right? They're completely innocent. The steward, though, confirms that they did honestly pay. There's no charge against them. He's not like, oh, yes, that was bad. He's like, no, all record I have is you paid. There's no charge against you. So they had paid, honestly. It got recorded. Then, secretly, the money got put back in their bags, but the record said they paid in full. They are innocent of that charge. The steward then goes a step further, perhaps by instruction of Joseph, perhaps the steward himself was a believer at this point, that's possible, obviously, and he says, your God and the God of your father can be credited for the money. He's like, my record says you paid. If you got money in your bag, that must have come from God. Okay? Really good answer, actually. Then the steward, this is amazing, returns Simeon to them. And you realize the steward knows exactly what happened last time. When he says, you paid and God gave you the money back, he knows the whole story. Because he's returning Simeon to them. Yes, it was a long time since they'd come already. They were supposed to come twice already, remember, and hadn't. And so this steward knows exactly what's happened. But he says, no, you paid, you're an honest man, and here's Simeon for you. If other things happen, that's between you and God. He confirms he does indeed remember the events of the previous visit very well. And so they enter the house, verse 24 to 34.
And when the man had brought the men into Joseph's house and given them water, and they had washed their feet, and when he had given their donkeys fodder, they prepared the present for Joseph's coming at noon, for they heard that they should eat bread there. When Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present they had with him, and bowed down to him to the ground. And he inquired about their welfare and said, is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? Is he still alive? They said, your servant our father is well. He is still alive. And they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. And he lifted up his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, and said, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? God be gracious to you, my son. Then Joseph hurried out, for his compassion grew warm for his brother, and he sought a place to weep. And he entered his chamber and wept there. Then he washed his face and came out, and controlling himself, he said, serve the food. They served him by himself, and them by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because the Egyptians could not eat with the Hebrews, for that is an abomination to the Egyptians. And they sat before him, the firstborn according to his birthright, and the youngest according to his youth. And the men looked at one another in amazement. Portions were taken out to them from Joseph's table, but Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs. And they drank and were merry with him.
All right, they come into Joseph's house. Joseph, though, as we read later, Hebrews were treated as barbarians, Joseph treats them with the full ordinary hospitality that you do for your own friends. Washes their feet, takes care of the donkeys. Okay, it's like saying, hey, coming from a long trip, can I get you a cup of coffee? And in the meantime, we'll wash your car. Okay, it's that kind of hospitality. They respond with respect to Joseph. They bring the offering from Jacob to him. They bow down again. Remember the dreams. Joseph then, in verse 27, does inquire very particularly nice. And it's true that he is asking the questions. And he says, is your father well, the old man of whom you spoke? So he still kind of throws it back at them. It's what they revealed. Is he still alive? And they say, yes, he's alive. And they bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. And then he sees Benjamin, his mother's son. He says, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? So he's still just acting upon the knowledge they revealed. But now the questions are very pointed. He said, God be gracious to you, my son. He doesn't ask about his mother, obviously, because she had died during childbirth with Benjamin, remember, in chapter 35. Verse 30, he hurries out because his compassion grew warm for his brother, especially Benjamin. He sought a place to weep, and he composes himself. He comes out again and says, serve the food. So he's still keeping his identity secret for a good reason. Yeah, we'll see how the story ends, which makes sense that it's still a secret. Verse 32, you get this random detail saying Joseph got served here, the Egyptians ate there, and the brothers ate there because it was an abomination. That's your strongest word for evil, disgust, inappropriateness. It's like if you would burn your son in a sacrifice to a false god. That's what that act is, an abomination to God. It's that kind of superiority, inferiority distinction here. So though they're eating in Joseph's house, with all hospitality and stuff from Joseph, there's still clearly this distinction in the house. It's this small little detail of extreme separation between them. And that explains a little bit why Joseph, for so long, with all these rather close interactions with his brothers, could keep his identity secret. Okay, they normally keep their distance, and so that wasn't very difficult. And then 33 to 34 is amazing. So he seats them in birth order. That's not something he asked about. Now he's acting on knowledge that he has of them that they don't know he has of them. So he seats them in birth order, and then Benjamin, the youngest, the least important of all the sons, gets this extra portion, fivefold, demonstrating he is the son of honor here. Which is exactly what probably happened at the Last Supper before they left home. Okay, they all sat around the dining room table, and Benjamin was definitely honored. And so now the gears start ticking. They're like, wait, what on earth is going on here? Now, up to now, the only explanation is your God and the God of your fathers is dealing with you. Okay, you're getting money, or you think he's after you, but you're actually getting money, and somehow God is arranging these things. This time, though, when they see the extraordinary fivefold honor, not just double honor, as would be common amongst Jacob's traditions, fivefold. When they see fivefold honor, they looked at each other, verse 33 at the end, in amazement. Then it says, Benjamin's portion was five times as much as theirs, and they drank and were merry with him. Now there is no envy and malice. Remember what happened when Joseph got a jacket, a coat, beautiful one, that they didn't get? It caused a murderous selling of their brother into slavery. Now, they just enjoyed the party. And so the test of their, let's put this all together now, the test of have my brothers changed? Was there a change of heart? That test is very pronounced in these two chapters. Though some elements of deception are still present among his brothers, there seems now to be a fear of God for what they've done, and there's a non-repeat of their sin against Joseph in their dealings with Benjamin. So that's very significant. Also, what you see in these two chapters, not just as his brothers changed, there's also the lesson of the nation of Israel, Jacob and his sons and their children, are being preserved through this drought. And even that comment of you could kill my two sons, as Reuben said, nobody's dying in Israel. Everybody's being preserved in Israel through this drought. In other words, God, the main character here very overtly a few times, right? God, the main character, doing all the good, is providing for his nation, Israel. And the third lesson we learn from these two chapters is that God's goodness to them is in striking contrast to their guilt. They are guilty and God is showing them good. You have to connect those two. It's not just God is good and they're bad. No, the outcome of their evil deeds is God's goodness to them. It's a complete reversal of what they have done. It's a very important lesson for Israel at Mount Sinai and for Moses' intercession for them when he pleads for Yahweh's continued goodness, is the word used, to them after the golden calf incident. And so in Exodus 32 is the golden calf incident. In Exodus 33, Yahweh particularly draws attention to his goodness when he tells Moses, when Moses and them are talking, about God shouldn't be with them, he's going to destroy them all, but his goodness means he will stay with them, provide for them, bring them back to the promised land. So these two chapters are not just fascinating stories. They make a great, great statement of the evil of man's heart, God's goodness to his people, and how God's goodness is directly in contrast to their evil. God doesn't just do good when there's evil. God turns the evil into good. And that's a great comfort for a nation of Israel who just worshipped the golden calf and still has to make it all the way to the promised land. Questions or comments from these two chapters? Details we perhaps skipped over. Daryl.
The 15-year thing that they recognize is very important that they recognize the numbers of the fact that you said it was 15 years, and that was because they even had just the best of it. But it's the Marat system that the text of the two of them, which means they're going to be the same age.
That would be another reason. Okay, Joseph was speaking the Egyptian language, and they were coming with the Hebrew language, or at least the language they were speaking at the time. Differently later, but a form of Hebrew. So yes, no, the differences were so striking that there's no surprise that they didn't recognize him. That he recognized them was obvious, because he used to dress like them, he used to speak like them. In fact, he understood them. Remember, that continues being said. They didn't know he understood, but he was understanding their language too. So that's it makes perfect sense why they didn't recognize him at all, and he instantly recognized them. Yeah, for sure. Sorry.
In verse 34, there's that specific phrase, and they drank and were married with him. When I initially read that, I just assumed with Joseph, yet you refer to the him as referring to Benjamin. When one comes across a verse like that, and there's a him, like, my mind just jumped to one of those two, and it jumped to a different one. How do you decide, like, which him
yes.
you're referring to?
So I was ambiguous. I don't think it necessarily refers to Benjamin.
Okay.
But it is the fact that they were enjoying the party instead of like, oh no, here we go again. We got rid of the favorite brother, now there's another favorite brother. Even in Egypt, he's a favorite brother. what are we going to do with this guy? Okay, he's never making it back alive. No, they were married. Actually, they were intoxicated with him. The question is, how do we know if it's Benjamin or Joseph? I'd probably lean towards Joseph here, to be honest. But since you asked the question, Benjamin is a good option. what do we do with pronouns and try and identify who it is? You always look at the nearest antecedent, the name that's closest to it before it. And so that could be Benjamin. But Benjamin's portion was five times as much as any of theirs, and they drank and were merry with them. So the they links to the theirs, and the him links to Benjamin. But it also says it's from Joseph's table and things like that. They served him by himself and then by themselves. So maybe Joseph is out of the picture by the time they're getting really merry, because he had to take care of affairs and things like that. So them could be Benjamin, actually, but could also be Joseph.
When it says they set the meal for him by himself, would that be like a big room and he's sitting there and they're sitting there and they're... Like, they could be enjoying it with Joseph?
Possibly,
like, yeah.
Eating
by himself.
Sorry?
44 verse 1, it has a he that's definitely Joseph, so...
Yes, then he commanded the steward of his house. So that one's obvious. And so the him could be Joseph. And so when it says they served Joseph by himself, it could be, like you're saying, in the same room still. Mm. Okay, he's the second in charge, okay? He doesn't exactly live in a little hut. And so it could well be a massive dining room, and he is sitting here, and then there are the Egyptians, and then there are the brothers on the other side of the room. They're all feasting together. Okay, it's very much they're at Joseph's house. And so the picture in my mind is definitely a big room, and they're all present, even though there's distinction. The hospitality indicates that too. But if it means that Joseph was actually in a private dining room down the hallway, completely separate from them, that's not entirely impossible either. The text doesn't reveal that for us. The hymn makes us realize how little we actually can reconstruct the exact details. But either one makes perfect sense. I would argue, based on just the purpose of this all, that Joseph is with them during this time, And it's a real brotherly moment. The fact that he's finally acting upon private knowledge of them that they don't know he has with the seating arrangement and the priority of Benjamin would make me argue for those not revealing his identity yet. There's an extraordinary mealtime moment of unity. And you know that, right? You talk to somebody in a church, a stranger, after tea. Oh, that's great fellowship. But you go home with them and invite them for a meal, that's a whole different level of fellowship, even though you might not know each other that well. And so I'm going to lean towards that, that they're all together in the same room, and they're feasting. Okay, what started with a kind of like, what on earth is going on here? And let's keep our distance because they don't like us and we're scared of them. Ended up with a lot of wine and a little looser interaction between them all. So when you fellowship, you can drink wine. That is the final concluding lesson of chapter 1. Let's pray. Our Heavenly Father, we are grateful to you for revealing this history for us. It seems somewhat unusual to get such particular stories recorded for us, not just the big picture scooping or big scoop ideas of your events, your actions, your engagements with mankind, but here, Father, very precise information of just these handful of individuals, and yet, very clearly, you are the one working here. And we thank you for that information. Father, help us start to recognize more often and more frequently and more clearly, more precisely, your hand of goodness in all the evil of this world, and how it's sometimes the very evil that gets flipped upside down, and a particularly good outcome comes when a particularly evil outcome should have been the result. Help us perceive that. May we be like that steward of the house that immediately pointed their attention to you as the ultimate cause of anything good that ever happens to us. May we praise you, even when we lay our heads down on a pillow tonight, looking at the good things that perhaps came at the hands of fellow Christians here at church or something like that, but may we see past them to recognize you are the one who has done us great good in spite of our evil, even through our evil. We praise you for having that effect on evil in this world. In Jesus' name.